On this week's 51%, we meet a filmmaker who delves into the world of same-sex ballroom dancing.
This is about diversity and inclusiveness of many kinds.
And writer Dr. Jerry Burns returns with a Halloween story she finds rather grim. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever.
In her documentary film, Hot to Trot, Hudson Valley, New York-based filmmaker Gail Friedman brings her audience into the world of same-sex ballroom dancing and into the lives of several dancers. In more than 20 years as an award-winning filmmaker, Friedman has produced, directed, and written dozens of documentaries on a wide range of subjects through her company Parrot Productions. She has also taught at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Among her films is Making the 9/11 Memorial, a primetime special for the History Channel, which aired on the 10th anniversary of September 11th when the memorial opened. Her creative output encompasses independent projects as well as extensive work for PBS, network television, cable, syndication, and the internet, along with educational and nonprofit films. 51% Sarah LaDuc spoke with Friedman about her new film, how she discovered the world of same-sex ballroom dancing, and asked her to describe the scene.
The scene is a kind of a little-known corner of the LGBTQ world, even among many members of the gay community. I discovered it quite by happenstance. I had just finished a remarkably different documentary about the making of the 9/11 Memorial in New York City, and had spent almost 2 years working on that. And my lead cameraman, who's another Hudson Valley resident, Joel Shapiro, Joel and I were casting about for another project and not really coming up with anything. And he happened to mention that he grew up in Philadelphia with a girl. Literally, he hadn't seen her since they were girl and boy, but that his cousin told him that she ran some kind of same-sex dance group on the West Coast. He didn't even know why he mentioned it. I can't even tell you why I responded as instantaneously as I did, but something in me just had that great big click. And I said, that sounds really fascinating. What more can you tell me? And he said, that's it. That's what I know. And I said, well, can you find out more? And he said, no, that's what you do. And indeed it is. And so I said, well, tell Barbara that I'm going to call her. And so it began. And I think initially it was really the joy and the beauty and the fact that it, you know, I'd come off of this project that was rooted in an unbelievable tragedy. And so I was looking for something that was more celebratory. And so all of that initially was what attracted me, the novelty, the beauty, the joy, the empowerment. But the deeper I got into it, the more I began to see that there was a lot of nuance and there was a lot of texture and there were a lot of layers, and that what these dancers were involved in, this whole same-sex competitive dance world, was small-p political as much as it was art and sport. And I got that from them. It wasn't like I imposed that on the narrative. They felt that very strongly. The mainstream dance world specifically excludes same-gender couples from competing, which in 2018 is fairly amazing. But the main dance organization in this country, Europe, is getting more advanced than the United States is on this. But the main dance organization in America explicitly defines a couple as a man and a woman, and a man leads and a woman follows, and that's the rule. And they went out of their way to reiterate that rule not long ago. And popular shows like Dancing with the Stars also do not allow same-sex couples to compete. They obviously have had a number of LGBTQ contestants, but always dancing with opposite gender. Again, I find that kind of amazing, and we hope maybe that this film will help shake that up a bit. So that it was this kind of hybrid of art and politics, and once that was clear to me, that was a sweet spot for me. I was in, and that was, I began this 6 years ago, so it was a long road. It was a real labor of love.
It gets to have that perfect, dramatic rise toward what any great sports movie has, a competition. We're following our people. Who's going to win? Are they going to win? It's close. et cetera, et cetera. So that's a just a wonderful narrative that you are given by virtue of doing a documentary about a competitive event.
Right.
You mentioned the dancers leading. Obviously, one dancer normally leads, and in a male and female couple, it is and has to be the man. How do the dancers, because there is someone who leads any given dance, how do the dancers of a same-sex dance team, and I'm sure it's different for each, decide who leads, or do they take turns depending on the number, or is there not a leader?
There are roles. I mean, and ballroom and Latin dance are actually very traditional forms, which is one reason, again, I think that this film appealed to me, because on the one hand, it's a very, in quotes, old-fashioned kind of an art form,
mm-hmm.
And very full of traditions and rituals and the costumes and how it's judged and all of that. But on the other hand, what they're doing is anything but traditional and hidebound. There are roles. There is lead and there is follow. It's not a man's role and a woman's role, as our characters make abundantly clear. It's lead and follow. And in fact, in the same-sex dance scene, the one time that a man and a woman may dance together is if it's reverse role and the woman is leading and the man is following. And how they divide those roles up is entirely up to them. And it's not about sexual identity or gender identity so much as it is who are you in the world and mm-hmm. which role are you most comfortable with, because they're very different kind of headsets to leading and to following. Some prefer to do one all the time, and others, like our lead male dance couple, Nikolai and Ernesto, they switch it up within a dance, which is something that's completely unique to same-sex dancing, that within a dance, they will switch who's leading and who's following. It's built in to the choreography, and it's a very difficult thing to do, not least because your headset has to change on a dime, and you have to either take on that lead role and embrace it, or kind of surrender to your leader and be in the moment and go into that follow mode. And it's a really fascinating thing to watch that happen. It's very exciting. And in fact, Nikolai is developing a whole curriculum built around all of that. So it brings up all kinds of issues, but it's completely up to them what they wear, how they divide up the lead and follow, how they choreograph their dances. There is an incredible flexibility and fluidity and excitement to it that doesn't exist in the mainstream dance world. And the other thing that I think was really noteworthy to me is that when you go to mainstream dance competitions, I mean, we all watch the television shows. If you remember the Strictly Ballroom, that movie from Australia some mm-hmm. years ago,
yes.
which was very much based in reality, there's this cutthroat kind of atmosphere at competitions. Yeah, our competitors want to win, too. They're all deeply competitive and performance-driven folks. But there is a supportiveness for everybody at their comps that is nothing like anything I've ever seen at any other sport event. And even if they're losing, they're rooting for the folks who just beat them. And I think that is all political, and it is rooted in a sense of community. And you mentioned before, you know, that this is a competition movie, and it is to some degree, but I would also argue that it isn't primarily a competition movie.
Oh, no, sure.
I mean, that probably was my original notion. It was probably a pretty conventional. I started in 2012. The next Gay Games, which are kind of the Olympics of the same-sex world, was coming up in 2014, and that's kind of the big enchilada for ballroom dancers. And I probably intended that that's where this would culminate. But in point of fact, it didn't end up working that way, and I kept shooting for almost another 2 years after that. So that I think at heart the film is really about the characters, but there is that kind of hopefully frisson of excitement that you get because we do follow them to the big comp without saying exactly what happens. We say what happens in the film, but I'm not going to say now.
Oh, no, yes, of course, we can't give that away. Yes, that's what I didn't say that way, but yes, you're right about your movie. it gets to have that the dramatic piece of the competition, but also is very character driven. And we watch these dancers. We learn a lot about them. You learned a lot about them. Do you count them as friends now? Feels like you are so invested and present in their lives.
Absolutely, I do count them as friends, very close friends in some cases. And, you know, we went on this long journey together, and they welcomed me into their world with incredible candor and openness. And that was a gift, and that was one that I took very seriously. And, you know, none of them saw the film until it was complete. So, and of course, we shot over a four-year period. So I think by the time they saw it on the big screen, which was the first place they all saw it at a festival, they'd forgotten many of the things that they had said.
I'm sure.
And it was a very emotional experience, which they've commented, because they come around to me to screenings with as much as possible. They come with me, and we do audience Q&As together. And so we've been on this whole trail through festivals for the past year and now at our theatrical run. And so they keep reliving this. And it's very powerful for them. And every now and then somebody will cringe and say, oh, gosh, I'm not sure how I feel about having had that revealed. But in the end, I think they all felt incredibly proud and positive, and that they were represented with integrity, which, you know, I wasn't looking to make a film that was a Valentine. I mean, it's obviously in the end, despite some of the pathos of some things that have happened, it's ultimately an optimistic and a positive film, and you leave the theater, I think, feeling good, not sad. So I do consider them to be friends, and they're very much in my life, and you know, they weren't sure along the way if I was going to finish.
Right.
It was very difficult to financially to get the film finished, and so I would show up. It's like, here she is again. I guess she means it. Okay, here she is again. And a few other people had tried to make a film about this world and had not finished for various reasons. So some of them had actually, particularly Emily and Kieran, my lead female dancers, who are based on the West Coast. They'd been through this a couple times before, and so at first I think they didn't know how seriously to take it. They were willing to do it. They were thrilled that someone wanted to make a movie about this world that is so important to them. But I think it was probably, you know, a couple of years before they realized, oh yeah, she really intends to make this happen. And so now, I mean, we've been all over the world together. I mean, we've been to London together and to New Zealand and, you know, all over this country. So it's become a close personal relationship. And that's great. I mean, to me, that's one of the payoffs for this work, is getting to know extraordinary people who you might well not know otherwise.
In addition to being a strong LGBTQ film, it is a gloriously multicultural film. Kieran's from New Zealand, Katerina's from Uzbekistan, Ernesto, of course, is from Costa Rica, Nikolai is from Russia by way of Kazakhstan, and Robbie's from Hungary, and other people are from other places. It's a huge part of the same-sex dance world is a lot of immigrants to America.
Absolutely. Of the six people who you get to know over the course of the film, only one of them was born in the United States. You know, I didn't set out to have that be a strong element in the film, but it became a really important sub-theme. And yes, that this is about diversity and inclusiveness of many kinds. You know, I think a number of, first of all, dance is bigger in some ways in Europe than it is in America, and virtually every child studies dancing as a kid, which isn't necessarily true here, although you see it more and more here. But it's much more common in Europe.
Mm-hmm. And more common for male children in Europe than male children in the United States, I think.
Absolutely. Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, you know, Ernesto and Nikolai and Robbie all danced as small boys. And there was no stigma attached to that, whereas sometimes here there yet might be. So I think, you know, there is that dance world is very much embedded in their culture. But equally, and not surprisingly, I think a number of them came to the United States because they perceived that it would be more open and more tolerant and that there would be more opportunities for them. I mean, Robbie talks about the fact that in his native Hungary, they were bombing gay bars, and he couldn't walk down the street holding another man's hand. And so there was that element. And Ernesto, in his native Costa Rica, was bullied from the time he was a kid. And even though he was always the charming, popular, incredibly charismatic person that he is, felt that in order for him to have a free and open life, he had to come to the United States, and an opportunity presented itself. He had some friends who moved here, and as he says, it was like this door that opened, and it was like, go, just go. And for Nikolai as well, I mean, Nikolai actually came here as a 19-year-old, and he had only ever danced with women. He had had a whole career dancing with women. And in fact, he married his first dance partner, and he and she came to the United States as young people. And I think, actually, I lied. I don't think they were 19. I think they were 22 because he was out of college. But they came here because another Russian had opened a dance studio here, and they had the opportunity to teach and to compete and to live a much freer life. Now, Nikolai was closeted at that point. He knew he was gay, but he was trying to live in the straight world. And that persisted for quite a long time. And even after he ostensibly had come out, when we first meet him at the beginning of the film, he's still not comfortable in his own skin, even though he's in America and he's successful and he's got a good life. But he still is struggling with his identity and with the fact that his family back in Russia has a hard time with this. And he can sort of barely bring himself to say the word gay. And I think over the course of the film, his arc, I mean, they all have things that happen in their lives, and we went along with that, not knowing where it would lead us. But I think perhaps Nikolai has the most dramatic personal arc in terms of how he evolves over the course of the film. He ends up someplace very different than where we first found him. But I think for all of them, coming to America was, as it has been for, you know, how many hundreds of years, an effort to have a better kind of life. And you know, when I started this film, which was in the pre-Trump era, I thought that it would be relevant and resonant, but it turns out to be in ways that I couldn't possibly have envisioned and would prefer not to have envisioned. But it's there is, I mean, not only I think are LGBTQ rights and other civil rights threatened again in our times, but there's such a polarity and a lack of unity right now. And we're at a time of such anger on all sides that I think the film seems to be striking a chord even more than I could have imagined when I began.
That was filmmaker Gail Friedman speaking about her documentary film, Hot to Trot. She was speaking with 51%'s Sarah LaDuc. And now writer Dr. Jerry Byrne shares her point of view on a potential horror.
I heard about something amazing, cutting edge, and a bit terrifying. I can't decide if it's a cool technological advancement or a digital Frankenstein's monster. So you be the judge. You're probably familiar with the names Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm. They are the famous German brothers who published over 200 stories in Germany in the 19th century. Now, even if you don't know their names or their books, you probably know some of their stories, many of which are versions of now world-famous tales. Stories like Rumpelstiltskin, The Frog Prince, Cinderella, Little Red Riding Hood, who the Grimm's brothers called Little Redcap, and so on. Well, the brothers Grimm have just published a new story. Now, I don't mean that a lost Grimm story was unearthed by researchers. I mean that a brand spanking new Grimm's tale has been released 150 years after their deaths. It's a technological feat that simultaneously intrigues and repulses me, a human being who, unlike the brothers Grimm, is very much alive. Here's the intriguing part. The story was composed by artificial intelligence. Build is the first bedtime story ever composed by AI. An organization called Botnik developed an algorithm like the ones used in phones to compose predictive text. The entire body of Grimm's stories was scanned for Grimmsian phrases, styles, sequences, and words. Human writers then took that information and sculpted it into a rough story, which they fed back into the computer program to test for, pun absolutely intended, grimness. The process went back and forth until eventually a story was written. This tale, The Princess and the Fox, is the first bedtime story collectively composed by machine and humans. It's supposed to be a calming tale, but the compositional process makes it a little too unsettling for my bedtime. It's not that collective story composition is an unprecedented thing. In fact, that's how the oral tradition works. Stories are reshaped by each teller. Some words, turns of phrase, and story sequences are recycled one after another to retell existing stories or craft new ones. So there are building blocks that remain the same from one version to another. But the interpretation is unique to each teller. Developing good narrative is a process, whether done through the oral tradition or at the keyboard by a solitary writer. It isn't easy for humans to do that well. I mean, there are many components in a story. While computers can predict words and phrases, can their algorithms grasp the emotion that courses through a well-told story? Can AI craft narrative with meaning that audiences can understand? What about writing original stories? Neil Patel over at Slate reports that AI can create original horror stories. Well, they're sort of original. Prompts from humans are needed to help stories begin, and then the program takes it from there. But because these story types don't need to flesh out characters, go on literary tangents, or delve too deeply into any backstory, they're not too challenging for AI to execute. So, okay, they are stories. But are they good and compelling? The bits I read of them, well, felt thin and bald and, dare I say it, the language sounded predictable. But whether one considers the stories to be good, bad, or meh, the upshot is that a bot can write horror stories, which is, if you ask me, a horror story itself. But as for other kinds of stories authored via algorithm, we're not there yet. That's because the technology is still built on language-based prediction, not meaning. In one trial, an AI was fed a bunch of science fiction screenplays. From there, the AI concocted its own short screenplay that filmmakers turned into a video. It's a short movie called Sunspring by the production company NQ. The human influence is clear in the artful videography. Every character had lines to speak. Actors, costumes, and camera shots did their best with the material. But they were challenged mightily because the story itself makes absolutely no sense. And so we are back to my first concern. Who puts the sense into bot-driven text? Emotion and meaning are the engine of stories because they are the engine of humanity. At Botnik, where the newly produced Princess and the Fox was created, there are real human writers who took part in the process to help the new Grimm's bedtime fairy tale make sense. But if the day should come when it's possible for artificial intelligence to make sense on its own, does it make sense for us to want that? Just my 2 cents. Don't get me wrong, I'm no Luddite. I embrace change and innovation like everyone else with a smartphone for an appendage. But in the service of transparency, I should also tell you that I'm a professional storyteller. Words and narrative are my life. So with that in mind, I, like artificial intelligence, have predictive abilities. And those, combined with my understanding of meaning and symbols, inspire some dystopian concern about this idea. Could AI recreate narratives from history, just like the new Grimm's tale, to be presented as fact and used to rewrite the past? Could AI storytellers substitute for and ultimately silence the power of human creativity? Since stories and their meaning grow our hearts, brains, and values, could AI-driven narratives inadvertently or purposely reconfigure human culture? As you can see, mechanizing art scares me, kind of like living in a horror story. Happy Halloween.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. She is co-author of the recently published book, Story Twisting, A Guide to Remixing and Reinventing Stories. Burns also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1526.